Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, or simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, NHK Japan, France 24, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Russia announced it has updated its nuclear policy. John Foreman, former defense attaché for the UK, explains what that means. Zelensky dismissed fear of a major Russian missile strike as a psychological operation. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Russia says the war has entered a new phase and it has updated its nuclear doctrine. John Foreman is a defense expert who served as the UK's defense attaché both in Kyiv and in Moscow in the last decade. He told me what Russia's reaction to all of this means.
Russia's been talking about updating its 2020 nuclear doctrine policy since September. And we already knew the sort of terms which we'd like to come out. And at the same time, we've known for quite a long time that Ukraine's been requesting long-range missiles from America for 2.5 years. So these two things have come together. Obviously, people have conflated the two issues. But actually, the nuclear policy doctrine updates is very much about strategic nuclear deterrence, about preventing a large-scale attack on Russia, which affects its ability to fire back nuclear weapons at the UK or France or at the United States. And actually, the attackman's issue is slightly separate, and I think much more tactical, which isn't covered in the doctrine.
In terms of nuclear weapons, I mean, what do you think would or could push Russia to ever actually pull the nuclear trigger?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, the good thing about having these policy documents actually sets out Russian thinking. So it's updated its military threats. It said that it would fire on warning of a large-scale aerospace assault against Russia, which, you know, attack as missiles doesn't matter, and also it would fire its nuclear weapons in response to a nuclear attack. I think in some ways those clarifications are important, but ultimately I'm not sure that the risk of to Mr. Putin of firing nuclear weapons would actually give him any reward, certainly in this context, whether against NATO. Russia's been very clear he doesn't want to escalate the war from Ukraine to a wider war with NATO. And of course, firing nuclear weapons or using nuclear weapons inside Ukraine would risk support from China and India, and also risk another reaction for the Americans against the Russian army deployed inside Ukraine.
Ukraine has dismissed warnings of a major Russian missile strike, blaming a psychological operation that it says is being carried out by Moscow. With the Ukrainian capital on alert, several Western nations, including the United States, closed their embassies in Kyiv in response to the threat. A day earlier, Ukraine used U.S.-made missiles known as ATACMS for the first time to hit an ammunition depot inside Russia. The Kremlin says a new phase of the war has now begun, and it is vowing to respond accordingly. As well as allowing Ukraine to use the missiles, the Biden administration has also given Kyiv the go-ahead to use American landmines.
That interview and report were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. They are also available at most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. Next, NHK Japan. Biden approved anti-personnel landmines for use in Ukraine, despite them being banned by 160 countries, including Ukraine. A new report came out about the devastating effect of landmines in Myanmar. The UK approved the Ukrainian use of long-range missiles into Russian territory, which were fired along with U.S. missiles. In New Zealand, tens of thousands of indigenous Maoris marched to Parliament, calling for their rights agreed upon in 1840 to be protected. Prior to the end of the G20 summit in Brazil, Lula da Silva called for an end to global inequality. NHK Japan.
Washington has announced more security assistance for Ukraine. It includes anti-personnel landmines, a type of weapon banned by most countries. The U.S. had previously given Ukrainian forces mines that are meant to destroy mechanized vehicles. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says the new ones are meant to help Ukrainian forces solidify their gains on the battlefield.
What we've seen most recently is because the Russians have been so unsuccessful in the way that they have been fighting, they've kind of changed their tactics a bit, and they don't lead with their mechanized forces anymore. They lead with dismounted forces.
More than 160 countries and territories are party to a treaty banning anti-personnel mines. The U.S. and Russia are not among them. But Austin says the U.S. will provide a variety known as a non-persistent mine. Those run on a battery and cannot explode when the charge runs out.
A new report illustrates the devastating effects of landmines in Myanmar. They killed or injured more people in the Southeast Asian country last year than anywhere else. The international campaign to ban landmines says there were at least 1,003 casualties in Myanmar. That's worse than Syria, which topped the grim ranking for the previous 3 years, and Ukraine. Myanmar is riddled with conflict. Many supporters of democracy have taken up arms against the junta, which seized power in 2021. The report says landmines are being used by both sides and armed ethnic groups. It also says evidence shows the military has used civilians as so-called guides, forced to walk ahead of troops in areas littered with mines.
Western media reports say Ukrainian forces have fired British-supplied Storm Shadow long-range missiles into Russian territory for the first time. U.S. media outlet Bloomberg on Wednesday quoted a Western official as saying Britain approved their use in response to Russia deploying North Korean troops in its war against Ukraine. Britain's Telegraph newspaper reported that fragments of a Storm Shadow missile were found in a village in Russia's western region of Kursk. The Storm Shadow is a cruise missile with a range of more than 250 kilometers. Russia's defense ministry announced on Tuesday that U.S.-made ATACMS missiles were fired into the Bryansk region bordering Ukraine. U.S. President Joe Biden has reportedly authorized the use of the missiles for targets inside Russian territory. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said President Vladimir Putin had spelled out how Russia's position would change if the use of long-range missiles were approved.
Now to New Zealand, where tens of thousands of people have marched to the country's parliament calling for the rights of the indigenous Maori people to be protected. Traditional chants echoed in the capital on Tuesday. The peaceful rally was organized to protest a bill reinterpreting the country's founding treaty between Maori tribes and the British Crown. The treaty signed in 1840 promises to protect the interests of the Maori community. Opponents say if the bill became law, it will undermine Maori rights. The architect of the bill is a conservative lawmaker who claims the founding treaty gives Maori special rights and discriminates against non-Indigenous citizens. When it was introduced in Parliament last week, one Maori lawmaker showed her opposition by tearing up a copy of the bill and performing the haka, a traditional Maori dance.
There's a strong depth of emotion on all sides of this debate. Yes, it's not something that I like or support.
Maori make up about 20% of New Zealand's population and suffer higher levels of poverty and imprisonment than the broader population.
Brazil has released a declaration ahead of the end of the G20 summit. It calls for an end to global inequality.
World leaders were expected to adopt a declaration on Tuesday, but Brazil released it Monday, saying the participants agreed with the content. Without naming any country, it said all states must refrain from the use of force to acquire territory. It also reiterated the members' commitment to the Paris Agreement, saying they'll continue to combat climate change. The declaration also pledges to support developing countries. It says inequality is at the root of most global challenges. It called for socially just and environmentally sustainable measures. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva had said Monday that the G20 has an urgent responsibility to act. He called the challenges of today a scourge that shames humanity and said they must be eradicated. All this comes as Donald Trump is preparing to return to the White House. He's claimed he will govern with an America First policy.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 9 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp, as well as most podcast sites. All the times they announce are for Pacific Standard Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. On to France 24. More on the conclusion of the G20 summit, where Lula da Silva called for a 2% wealth tax on the super rich and an advanced schedule for zero carbon emissions, while he learned of a plotted assassination attempt in 2023. A press review on accusations that Australia is increasing carbon pollution from the planned gas expansion in the West. Studies have shown how war greatly increases planet-warming gases being released into the atmosphere. The Arava Institute has been working with reducing carbon emissions in Palestine for 7 years. France 24.
It's been 2 days of negotiating and debating, but little in the way of concrete decision-making here at the G20 summit in Rio, where world leaders discussed combating world poverty and hunger, reforming institutions of global governance, and also the climate crisis. President Lula also proposed a 2% tax on the super rich, and he urged his fellow leaders to aim for net zero carbon emissions by 2040, 10 years ahead of schedule. In the end, though, the joint declaration contained lots of lofty rhetoric, but little in the way of substance. Even so, it's being considered a diplomatic success. But on the final day, worrying news for Lula. 4 members of the military and 1 federal police officer arrested, accused of plotting to assassinate him soon after his election victory in 2022 against former President Jair Bolsonaro. Now, one of them is a retired army general who worked for Bolsonaro's government. And what's more, it appears that the plot was printed off at the presidential palace, the Planalto, and taken to Bolsonaro's residence while the former president was at home. Now, all of this has come to light in the investigation into the attempted coup in January 2023 by Bolsonaro supporters. Bolsonaro himself is under investigation for his alleged role in that attempted coup, and it's expected that he could even be charged when that concludes, hopefully at the end of this year.
Let's move on to Australia now, where the government there has been accused of exporting climate destruction.
As you can see in The Guardian this morning, at COP29 in Baku, representatives from the tiny island nations of Tuvalu and Vanuatu have called on Australia to stop approving new fossil fuel developments. They're particularly critical of Australia's plans for a massive gas industry expansion in Western Australia. They say that would directly affect them and could result in 125 times more greenhouse gas emissions than their island nations released in 1 year. Australian leaders have been accused of hypocrisy for standing on the world stage and promoting their climate credentials while also approving these deals. Emissions from the gas protest at this particular plant could result in up to 6 billion tonnes of emissions. Australia, actually the world's third largest fossil fuel exporter. And it's interesting because if you look at the front page of one of the country's biggest newspapers this morning, you can see the juxtaposition, because they have this message in stark contrast with with the message from the Pacific nations: give coal a chance to rein in energy risks. One of the world's major miners has urged the Albanese government to slow down the transition from coal to renewable energy, warning that Australia risks falling behind other nations, especially as Donald Trump puts in motion his plan to expand the fossil fuel industry in the United States. One of the world's largest mining companies has revealed the price it pays for energy in Australia is almost as twice as much as other countries such as US or Canada or India. Australia's attitude towards coal, that CEO says, is out of step with the rest of the world. And Australian stakeholders just don't want to have a conversation about coal anymore, he says.
One study said that in the first months of the war, produced more planet-warming gases than 20 climate-vulnerable nations do in a year. In June, another report said that rebuilding Gaza after Israel's bombardment would come at an environmental cost of 60 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. We're now in the second and final week of the UN Climate Conference. Hosting COP29 is Azerbaijan, a small, oil-rich country with a poor human rights record. That, though, does not diminish the importance of addressing the climate crisis. And joining us from Baku is Dr. David Lehrer. He leads the Center for Applied Environmental Diplomacy at the Arava Institute for Environmental Studies. Thank you for speaking to Paris Direct. You're attending the summit. Let me ask you, with wars in the Middle East and Europe, plus Donald Trump's re-election, does it feel like COP29 is being overlooked some?
Yeah, that's definitely my feeling. I feel like the world's attention has shifted from this incredible climate crisis that is going to impact everyone on this planet to wars in my area in the Middle East, to Ukraine and Russia, and to the U.S. elections. I'm afraid that not enough attention is being made to the efforts that need to be made by everyone cooperating on a worldwide scale in order to stop the rise of temperature on the planet.
Yeah, and your institute, Arava, has been trying to address the situation in Gaza. Talk to us about that project.
We've been working at the Center for Applied Environmental Diplomacy together with Palestinian partners in West Bank and in Gaza, Palestine, for 7 years now on ways to help people who live in off-grid communities, vulnerable communities in the West Bank and in Gaza, in the central Negev of Israel, who have a lack of water, a lack of energy, of sewage treatment, in order to first and foremost improve people's lives, and second of all, to really prove that Palestinians and Israelis can work together. On October 7th, when the war broke out, our Palestinian colleagues, we were meeting with them, and they said now the crisis has to shift towards immediate humanitarian needs. And we began to work with them on not only answering the immediate humanitarian needs, but trying to take a look at how people are going to be living in displaced persons camps along the coast of Gaza, not just for a few weeks or a few months, but possibly for years. So we need to make these, what our Palestinian partners call green refugee shelters, sustainable. So we work together with them to bring in technology that will supply energy, water, wastewater treatment systems, food, tents that are appropriate for winter, and other immediate needs. Obviously, the people are most familiar, of course, with solar panels and batteries, which can provide electricity without using fossil fuels. And prior to October 7th, there was quite a bit of solar energy being used in Gaza because the electrical grid was so unreliable. People were only receiving electricity from the grid 4 to 6 hours a day. And so many had already adopted solar energy. But when the war broke out, of course, people lost their homes and had to flee away from their homes and were living in the streets and eventually in camps. So solar energy, solar panels, together with batteries, can provide people with the much-needed electricity that they're lacking. The Arava Institute has developed an off-grid wastewater treatment system. Even prior to the war in Gaza, treated wastewater was rare in the West Bank and in Gaza. There are 14 million people living between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River, 7 million Israelis, 7 million Palestinians. None of us are going anywhere. We need to learn how to live in peace and in sustainability together.
Thank you very much, David Lehrer, joining us from Baku. Thank you.
Those reports were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They're also available at most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this program, like a new monthly supporter in Cleveland, Ohio did, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show airborne. Join them, please. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please, they need your support as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. The United Nations Security Council was warned that the conditions in Gaza are the worst ever. Deadly Israeli airstrikes continue in central Beirut, Lebanon. Pope Francis called for an investigation into genocide in the war in Palestine. The Australian Senate censured an Aboriginal senator for demanding that King Charles return the land that Britain stole from the native people. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The United Nations Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process has warned the Security Council that conditions in Gaza are among the worst we've ever seen during the entire war and are not set to improve. The warning came as Sri Lanka's UN ambassador delivered the annual report by the UN Special Committee on Palestinian Human Rights. Pir Muhad Maitri Piris said this year's report examines the massive civilian casualties and life-threatening conditions intentionally imposed on Palestinians in Gaza. Our findings conclude that Israel's methods of war align with the characteristics of genocide.
An Israeli airstrike targeting a building in central Beirut has killed Hezbollah spokesman Mohammad Atrif, according to officials from the Lebanese armed group. Three other people were injured in the strike in the densely populated Ras al-Naba district in the Lebanese capital, officials said on Sunday, adding that the building was targeted without warning. Many Lebanese, displaced by Israel's ongoing strikes in Beirut's southern suburbs, had taken refuge in the neighborhood. The Israeli military had not officially ordered the area to be evacuated ahead of the deadly strike on its handle on X. Clearly, this is a continuation of the Israeli policy to go after not only the military wing of Hezbollah, but also officials within the administrative side of the organization, said Al Jazeera's Dorsa Jabari. What Israel is trying to do is diminish the group's capabilities on all fronts, economic, social, political, and military. Afif managed Hezbollah's Al-Manar television station for several years before taking over as the top media relations officer for the armed group. He hosted several press conferences amid the rubble in the southern suburbs of the capital devastated by weeks of Israeli bombardments. In his most recent comments to reporters on November 11, he said that Israeli troops had been unable to occupy any territory in Lebanon and that Hezbollah had enough weapons and supplies to fight a long war. His killing is the latest in a string of assassinations of top Hezbollah leaders, including its chief Hassan Nasrallah, since Israel dramatically intensified its attacks across Lebanon in late September after 1 year of fire exchanges along the border. Nasrallah was assassinated in an Israeli strike on a residential building in southern Beirut's Dahiyeb neighborhood in late September. Military analyst Elijah McNear told Al Jazeera that the killing of Afif is part of Israel's strategy to disrupt Hezbollah's leadership and its ability to communicate with the world. It will also undermine Hezbollah's ability to coordinate responses that counter Israel's war narrative.
Pope Francis, head of the Catholic Church, has called for an investigation into Israel's ongoing onslaught on the Gaza Strip, as experts say it amounts to genocide against Palestinians. He made the request in his forthcoming book, whose excerpts were published by Italy's La Stampa Daily on Sunday. The reports say Pope Francis has privately used the word genocide to describe Israel's bloody aggression on Gaza. It is the first time he has publicly called for an inquiry to determine if the usurping regime's attacks meet the legal definition of genocide. A UN special committee set up in 1968 to monitor the Israeli occupation said that Israeli policies and practices in the besieged Gaza Strip are consistent with the characteristics of genocide. In its annual report, it is said there were serious concerns that Israel was using starvation as a weapon of war in the besieged Palestinian territory. Australia's Senate has voted to censor Indigenous lawmaker Lydia Thorpe after she heckled Britain's King Charles III during his visit to Parliament last month. The vote, led by Australia's Governor Labour Party, was passed with 46 votes in favour and 6 against. Lydia Thorpe, a Gunani Gunditjmara and Jadwurrung woman who represents the state of Victoria, released a statement before the vote, saying she will not be silenced by the measure. "I will not be silent. The truth is, this colony is built on stolen land, stolen wealth and stolen lives," Thorpe said in a statement. "The British Crown committed heinous crimes against the First Peoples of this country. These crimes include war crimes, crimes against humanity, and failure to prevent genocide. The Crown must be held accountable for these crimes," she added. Charles was attending a ceremonial welcome and parliamentary reception at Australia's Parliament House in Canberra on October 21st, when proceedings were briefly interrupted by Thorpe's protest. "You committed genocide against our people. Give us our land back. Give us what you stole from us," Thorpe yelled out as she entered the room where the king was being officially welcomed. "Our bones, our skulls, our babies, our people. You destroyed our land. This is not your land," she continued as security guards led her away. Recordings of the protest were viewed and shared around the world, with a rare direct protest against the British monarch sparking consternation from some and celebration from others. After the censor was passed by the Senate, Thorpe ripped a piece of paper it was printed on into pieces, Australia's public broadcaster reported. The gesture appeared to be a nod to New Zealand's Te Pāti Māori legislator, Hannah Rawiti, my AP clerk, who last week ripped out a copy of a bill revising a treaty that granted land rights to Māori tribes before beginning the traditional haka dance in protest.
That report was from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 5 p.m. to 11 at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you could stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Standard Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to look even harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online donations. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I'm still recuperating from spinal injury, I'm staying in a house that is connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.